Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Mainline Protestant denominations are continuing to struggle with the major shift in public attitudes on the acceptance of homosexuality and same-sex marriage over the past decade and a half or so. While court rulings on discrimination issues and same-sex marriage clearly exempts religious institutions and organizations, denominations are clearly wrestling with the impact of these decisions on basic church functions, such as who can become a member of the church and under what conditions, whether to allow same-sex marriages, whether to bless same-sex unions, and whether to ordain clergy who are gay. Today we'll hear about this divide as it affects the United Methodist Church through the eyes of one minister. Reverend Cynthia Meyer was the pastor of the Edgerton United Methodist Church in a small Kansas town just southwest of Kansas City when she publicly came out as gay in the pulpit at the beginning of the year. Now, the United Methodist Church allows LGBT people to become members but prohibits gay clergy and same-sex marriage. But in practice, how these church beliefs are enforced vary widely across the country. It was expected that the denomination would address this issue during its May General Conference. Perhaps that was part of the reason Reverend Meyer came out. But instead, a commission was formed to further study the church's position, leaving her in limbo. She has been in Tulsa speaking to several churches and the Phillips Theological Seminary today, and she joins us as well here on Studio Tulsa. Reverend Meyer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Take us back to the beginning of this year, January 2016, when you made a momentous decision in your life as a religious leader, and that was to come out to your congregation at Edgerton United Methodist Church.
Right. Well, a lot had happened before January, and some of that was about falling into a new relationship and deciding that I was committed to that relationship and that I felt that is consistent with my Christian faith and leadership in the church. And a new calling started to develop in my life to speak out about that and not to hide, not to feel myself a victim in any way, but to speak out actively and visibly. And so a lot of prayer and discernment came from that. And I did decide that in January I would speak publicly. And that was done through a sermon in the Edgerton United Methodist Church, a small church in Kansas where I was serving. But I also worked with the Reconciling Ministries Network in the United Methodist Church to think about how perhaps this might be most helpful in moving the United Methodist denomination forward to full inclusion and acceptance of everyone.
Right now, the United Methodist Church's belief is homosexuality's incompatibility with Christian values. Is that the terminology, or do I have it messed up a little bit?
That's pretty close to some of the wording in our Book of Discipline, incompatible with Christian teaching. But I have to say the United Methodist Church is a really big tent, and there are folks with a wide, wide range of views. Some are what would be labeled more traditional and conservative, and they might support that idea. Others are progressive and ready to move forward. Our Book of Discipline also states that all persons are of sacred worth, and that also is speaking directly to issues about sexuality and homosexuality in particular, but it only assures a right of membership and participation in the church and care by the church, and the limits are around weddings, same-sex weddings, and the service of clergy.
Now, is there differences in different parts of the country in United Methodism? I'm saying you're in Kansas. I would think that may be a more conservative conference as opposed to, say, Northern California or Oregon or the East Coast,
right,
for example.
There are really significant differences across parts of the country. The United Methodist Church has five larger regions called jurisdictions, and the entire western jurisdiction, California, Oregon, Washington, etc., has decided that they will not adhere to those particular discriminatory policies in the Book of Discipline. So they are following a path that's been labeled biblical obedience rather than disciplinary obedience. And the biggest sign of that is that this past summer, the first out lesbian bishop was elected, and she's serving now in Colorado and other states in the West in what's called the Rocky Mountain Great Sky Conferences. So mm-hmm. we're really in a very interesting place right now. Where
now, how's that reconciled in the whole United Methodist Conference? I mean, I mean, the whole church within the United States. I would assume this is a big issue, and I know that in your general conferences, this has been an issue for right.
44 years.
44 years?
Yes.
Wow. Wow. This has been looked at, and, mm-hmm. and as a, I guess at this point, the position has never been changed.
It's, in fact, the discrimination has increased over time as homosexuality became more of a public issue in our culture, I think, as the conservative elements of the church have felt more challenged. The rules have been tightened, but at the same time, the movements of resistance working for full equality have strengthened as well. So there are many reconciling congregations across the country. Those are churches that have done some study and come together to say, we want to not just welcome all, but affirm all and continue to work for justice across the denomination.
I think at first glance, when somebody might look at your case from afar, they would say, why are you a United Methodist minister? But given the fact that the whole values vary so greatly mm-hmm. across Methodism, across the country, it makes sense. I mean, was that message that you gave in early January, was it basically wanting to push the faith to confront this issue, or was this just a personal decision on your part?
Well, it was a multifaceted decision. Certainly it had personal elements, but I did think and plan and wanted to have my coming out story in the church have the most impact that I thought it might. So the timing was intentional. The planning was intentional. So the sermon that I preached was videotaped, and it's out there now available on YouTube, both the short clip and the full sermon. And I think those are helpful perhaps for folks to watch to see what that was all about and how I can frame that within the context of my faith and my ministry.
What was the reaction in Edgerton and within your church?
Sure. I had worked with a team of five leaders in the church for a couple of months before the sermon so that it would cause the least disruption as possible, and so that we were pastoral and caring for everyone in the congregation. And so we had thought about who might need a little extra care, who might be troubled, and all of that. So we were well prepared, and really the response was wonderful and a beautiful thing. I could see folks nodding their heads and some giving me signs of encouragement as I was preaching and tears in a lot of eyes. And after the service, folks came through the line and lots of hugs and affirmations and indications of their love and care for me and for my partner, Mary, who was there that day. And so that was a great thing. We had a conversation for all that wanted to stay right after church to address questions and concerns. And I think that was really helpful. And there as well, people were quite positive.
Was this more of a public declaration, or was this really a true coming out to your congregation? I mean, was your sexuality known to most of the congregation before you publicly proclaimed it?
I think some had an awareness. Mm-hmm. It had not been discussed in any way, because that's not safe in a religious denomination that chooses to discriminate. So I had not talked about it other than with that selected team as we prepared to move forward. So I think there were a lot of people who were not surprised. Many people will understand that experience from their own experience in their families or workplaces. There were some, I think, who, you know, that's just kind of not on their radar or mm-hmm. who would not want to see that because it would be hard for them to reconcile that a pastor that they seem to appreciate might be a person that they had decided not to accept on some categorical definition. And so it really was a first more public moment. I have been somewhat out in other realms of my life more privately, but so it was not entirely new for me, but mm-hmm. in terms of the church, it was something new.
Yeah. Now, what was the reaction from the conference? Because you videotaped it, it was out there. This was designed to get, I assume, a reaction from your conference.
Well, part of what it was about was making a public statement and to make that effectively in the church. We shared the sermon itself with the district superintendent, which is the sort of first level of oversight in our denomination. I let him know about that later the same day. And a couple days later, he filed a charge against me based on the regulations in the Book of Discipline. And I do assume that that charge came after his discussion and at the direction of the bishop that we had at that time.
What's been the reaction within your conference to this, to your decision? Have you gotten private support and yet, you know, publicly, I would assume that the conference has to remain, has to follow the official teachings. Have you had that sort of...
We've had really a good bit of public support from many clergy and laity across the conference and much beyond that too. But the process that followed the charge included pretty quickly a meeting with the bishop to work towards what's called a just resolution. And I hesitate to estimate, but probably 75 people came to stand outside in the cold in January in support of me at that time, clergy and laity from the conference. Of course, officially, the conference was not at all accepting of this sort of behavior. And the bishop we had at the time was very much someone who believes the church should live by the law of its Book of Discipline. So that means we moved forward in the process of responding to the charge. And
you were under suspension.
I was not suspended immediately.
Okay.
That could have happened. We anticipated that that would happen. But there's another body in the church that oversees the ordained ministry, and they're called the Board of Ordained Ministry. And when the bishop asked for my suspension, it would require the approval of the executive committee of that board, and they did not grant that approval. So I was allowed to remain as the pastor in Edgerton, and that lasted until the end of August, so which was a great gift to me and the congregation. I think that that was helpful and healing. And in August, I did come to an agreement with the bishop. We worked with the process of mediation because the next step was to go to a church trial, which is just as ugly as it sounds. And a very hard process.
I'm having sort of a vision of Puritans in
Massachusetts. It feels a lot like that. It feels a lot like that. It's structured very much as a civil court of law. And but it's very, very hard on the annual conference and churches and people within it. There's always concern about the financial cost of that kind of endeavor, but also just a great personal cost and turmoil. And because of the way the process moves forward, the way those who serve as jurors and the trial judge really are selected, it's a biased process. And there was almost no likelihood that that anything would have come from that other than a lot of pain and anxiety, and I would have lost my orders at that point.
So you still have your orders, given your...
Yes,
situation.
I still have my orders as an elder in the United Methodist Church, which is our standard order for ministers. Mm-hmm. However, I am on involuntary leave and cannot perform the duties of an elder. So I am free to work otherwise in a church in a position that a lay person might have or to do other sorts of things, but I cannot be active in the ministry to which I've been called.
Now, you mentioned you've separated from your church in August, and that comes after the Methodist General Conference in either June or July, I think, earlier that summer. And this was a big issue at the General Conference.
Right.
Was this a part of the, again, you referred to it as the multifaceted strategy of coming out at the beginning of the year. Was this part of that? Are you expecting action at the General Conference?
Yes. There was a lot of activity on from multiple positions leading up to the General Conference, which was in May, and several issues around LGBT rights were brought before the General Conference, or were supposed to be brought before the General Conference. And in fact, decisions were made that they really did not. And the General Conference chose instead to choose a new study, to have the bishops appoint a new commission on what's called a way forward, which really is entirely about issues involving LGBTQ individuals in the church. But that is never mentioned in the language of the document. And the commission has been appointed. And out of 32 members on the commission, two are white gay men. They are the only LGBTQ representatives that we know of, out and open folks on that commission. So there's a lot of frustration that, once again, leaders in the church will be talking about us and not with us. We have very minimal representation at that table. So we're not overly confident about what might come next.
And a lot of mainstream denominations have come to an accommodation, usually with some sort of strife, with some splinter mm-hmm. groups that leave. Where would you say the Methodist Church is at this particular point over gay and lesbian issues within the church? Is it very much in danger of a split? How would you see it? I mean, it seems like at this point they're avoiding the question.
Right. There's a lot of discussion around that right now, as you might imagine. The more conservative or traditionalist movements in the church have a lot of strength and are very, very organized and have created some new structures. They have clearly articulated that a sort of my way or the highway position. So the nice talk is about unity, the desire for unity. But folks like me would say what they're asking for is unity without justice, and that's not acceptable. So we don't know where that may head. We all try to live in hope. I certainly would love for the church to stay together as one denomination and learn to be open and loving and accommodating and allow for options. And there are several options that have been discussed about how this might work. But I don't know. While I'm hopeful, I'm not particularly confident at this point.
My guest today is Reverend Cynthia Meyer. She's the former pastor of the Edgerton United Methodist Church in Kansas, about 40, 45 miles southwest of Kansas City, who came out to her congregation in January of 2016. And she's in Tulsa speaking to several congregations and to Phillips Theological Seminary. I want to ask you the bigger question. There are mainline Protestant denominations that are accepting. Why not? You know, if the Methodists are not going to make that change, why not switch to another denomination? Is there something particular about Methodism that speaks to you personally?
I grew up in a sort of non-churched family, and when I was a junior high student, became involved with the local United Methodist Church, which was just down the street from my home. And I found there some things that really spoke to me, touched both my heart and my mind, and helped me to learn a little about my spirit. One part of that was about social justice and the church's greater role in the world, about involved with recognizing everyone's sacred worth and need for human rights and inclusion, and how we are all enriched by living in a diverse society and a diverse church and caring for one another. And I'm very committed to those things. And I think that if United Methodism is true to itself as a denomination, it is committed to those things. I have 26 years, more than 26 years of service as an ordained elder in the church, and my connections and my community are largely there, and I want to cling to the hope that the church can be more fully what it's called to be.
You know, there certainly are a lot of clergy members who have been in similar situations that have switched denominations. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most of those denominations are welcoming to clergy from other denominations. If you have, you know, if you have the right education, you can do that. So there's something particular about Methodism that does speak to you, that long history.
Yeah,
it
does.
And wanting to see your church change what you believe to be the right practices.
Right. Yes, I love the church that I know and have high hopes and dreams for it. That being said, I am really not interested in investing the rest of my ministry in this battle. I think there are more important things to be done in the world. And so I'm in a process of discernment yet again about what the future holds and whether that my calling is really to continue down this road with the United Methodists or to look at other possibilities where perhaps they're past this particular concern and more energy can be devoted to doing good in the world.
It's really surprising as I was reading about your situation. I was on the United Methodist Church's publication website, and the motto of the, I guess, at the United Methodist Church at this point is open hearts, open minds, open doors, which to me seems pretty open and inclusive. Is there any, I mean, what does that motto mean if it doesn't mean open and inclusive?
Well, a lot of us question that. A lot of us do question the use of that kind of advertising tagline when the openness is limited in the ways that it is in the United Methodist Church. One of the things that troubles me so greatly is that we will welcome folks in, at least in most churches. Officially, we welcome folks as members, meaning they were maybe baptized at any point in life. And in baptism, the church makes some promises to folks coming in. And when we then deny those people the right to have their wedding in our sanctuaries or performed by our clergy because it is a same-sex wedding, the church is not living into the promises that it has made. So I think it's a great conflict, and really at this point it would be more appropriate for the denomination to remove that advertising line from all of its materials and perhaps state something different.
Now, what's the reaction from your congregation in Edgerton, given everything that happened, everything with the General Conference,
sure.
and the resolution of your case? Has it affected your congregation much?
Well, many of them were deeply invested in all of this, and they understood that I was the same minister after I shared this information with them as I had been in our prior time together. So they are continuing a bit of activism around all of this. I think they're a very healthy congregation. It's obviously been hard on them. But I saw a great picture a few weeks ago. We have a new bishop in the Great Plains Conference, and there had been an event for churches and members in a district to meet the new bishop. And they took a picture of the Edgerton folks that had gone to meet the bishop. So the new bishop and the district superintendent who brought the charge against me, 14 members of the Edgerton Church went, which is a lot for that kind of an event. And many of them were wearing the rainbow stoles that are a sign of protest in the church. I thought that was bold and courageous on their part that they chose to go meet the bishop and face the district superintendent, proudly proclaiming their understanding around this issue.
Now, if certain general areas of the church are not following this dictate, have you considered moving to one where you are, or is this decision sort of impacted that ability to move to another district and serve a church?
There are things in the agreement that I reached that are not entirely clear how they can be worked out. The superficial reading of being on involuntary leave limits my ability to transfer to a different conference. However, some of those conferences that are already living outside the bounds of the Book of Discipline on these issues are willing to consider that, and I have had conversations with some of those folks in other conferences, but haven't made any decisions yet.
Yeah. So right now, the United Methodist Church has this commission that correct me if I'm wrong, but it hasn't actually been done any work yet at this point. They're supposed to report back in a couple of years. Do you think that there'll actually be a report back? Do you think you actually see a movement to change this issue within your church? Or is this church going to stay with this foundation of discrimination against homosexuals within their doctrine?
Right. Well, I trust that the commission will meet. It has been formed at this point, and the plan for meetings is set. I don't think it's a well-balanced body. I think that the more conservative groups will hold sway in the commission. And sadly, I think recent developments in our country lend some support for that. That will make it more complicated. So I don't know. There may be a called general conference in 2019 to look at these issues. Our next regularly scheduled general conference is the following year. So at one or the other of those times is when all of this will come back to the table.
Now, as a denomination, I mean, when these issues are considered, and it sounds like within the United Methodists, it's sort of not really had a up or down vote on this particular issue, but when issues pertaining to it are considered, it's a pretty close vote, isn't it? It's like 55-45.
Right. Yeah, there have been...
I mean, there's a major split.
Yeah,
within this
several things have come to vote in past general conferences, and it is very nearly a 50-50 split. We're well aware that if the United Methodist Church was a denomination only in the United States, that would have happened differently. We would have made progress earlier. But we're a worldwide denomination, and many of the United Methodist strongholds in other parts of the world are in African countries and others that are very restrictive around human sexuality. And that's a reality, and it's also something that has been taken advantage of in a political sort of way to prevent forward movement towards inclusion.
All right. Well, we wish you success. So right now you've been talking to churches around you're here mm-hmm. in Tulsa speaking to churches. What are your sort of immediate plans as far as what you do as far as your ministry?
Right.
Your own personal ministry.
Right. I've been unemployed for a couple of months now and have been doing a bit of speaking. It's been a joy to be here in Tulsa. I spoke at St. Paul's United Methodist Church yesterday, a wonderful, inclusive congregation. I recommend them to anyone who might be looking for that kind of place. I am looking at some options. I've had several job interviews. I made a bold decision to let one possibility go that might have been exciting but didn't seem quite right, and have a couple of other things on the table right now. I'm right at a point where I can't speak too much mm-hmm. to that. But I hope to be back in a ministry sort of position very soon, and will continue to speak out as I am able as well.
Reverend Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Reverend Cynthia Meyer is the former pastor of the Edgerton United Methodist Church in Kansas. She's been in Tulsa speaking to several congregations, as well as to Phillips Theological Seminary, where she's speaking today. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.